Oh, is that a segue or is that a segue? Brad Walker talking about pianos right into our beautiful Steinway here in Studio S, performed by Michael Brush on piano. His colleague Julie Milady will be joining us here in just a few minutes. Together, they're known as Brush Street, and they're playing for you live here this morning from Studio S on WKAR's Current State. More from Brush Street later this hour. We've also got a book review from Scott Southard coming up. He reviews Donald Lystra's Something That Feels Like Truth and a look ahead at all of our spring films, kind of the crop of films that show up between the Oscars and the Memorial Day movies, the real summer movies. We'll be talking with John Serba of MLive about that in just a few minutes. We're glad you're along. It's Friday the 14th. The controversy over wolf hunting continues in Michigan with new developments this week. Last November and December, hunters killed 23 wolves in three parts of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. That was a little more than half the number allowed under the state's new wolf hunting rules. Now, the wolf debate didn't end with the hunt, though, and the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta joins us now to try to sort out the, what's becoming a ballot battle over Michigan.
And will become a bigger one. By the way, it's great being here in Cafe Current State.
Yes.
Like the piano jazz and the lattes.
This is the, yes, we got to work on those lattes. But Rick, where do we stand today regarding November ballot proposals? That's really what this adds up to this mm-hmm. week. Regarding wolves, I understand there may be more than one.
Well, there will be. You know, so everyone, pull out your piece of paper and start making graphs because it gets a little complicated. There is already one wolf hunting referendum on the ballot for a law that was passed last year by the legislature to permit a limited wolf hunt in the Upper Peninsula. The group Keep Michigan Wolves Protected, which is made up of the Humane Society, the Audubon Society, some Indian tribes, went out and collected petition signatures to get a referendum on the ballot, which also suspended the law. So the legislature, to basically get around that, went and passed another law. That law is the target of this particular petition challenge. And so if Keep Michigan Wolves Protected, that campaign has, once again, and since they've done it before, I think we can be pretty confident that they'll succeed this time, went out and got signatures. And once they're certified, probably about a month from now, elections officials have to basically, check the signatures. They'll take a random sample. They'll go and see how many of those are valid. And from that, they will extrapolate sort of a percentage of how many of them are, right and properly collected signatures of registered voters. And then that will suspend the existing hunting law. So does that end it, you ask? Because I can do both of our jobs, Mark.
Does that end it, Rick?
No, it does not. There is another petition drive that's out there, and right now they're working gun and knife shows, outdoor ramas. They're collecting signatures at hunting supply shops, big retailers and small ones, to put an initiated law on the ballot that would basically reenact the existing hunting law that gives the Natural Resources Commission the exclusive authority to set these hunting seasons, which means that they couldn't be challenged on the ballot, at least not via a referendum. And so that would once again circumvent the referendum if it makes it onto the ballot. So we could have two essentially meaningless referendums on the ballot. So what will happen once they turn in their signatures, probably in mid-May, is there will be a battle in the legislature about whether the legislature will adopt that law. That's the way an initiated petition law works, is that you turn in the petitions, that it's just like the citizens via a ballot drive introduced a bill, just like they were a legislator, and then the legislature has 40 days to either act on it, to approve it, or if they reject it or don't act on it at all, to let it go to the ballot. And so what they will be lobbying on is whether the legislature should just adopt this law or whether it should go on the ballot in November and be fought out with the other ballot questions on hunting and wildlife management here in Michigan.
Is it known how Michigan voters tend to feel about the wolf hunt? In other words, if these measures went to the ballot, do we have a good handle on how voters are likely to respond?
Well, the polling would suggest that that voters would repeal the law, that they would support the referendum and vote no on the wolf hunting season. And the complaint there is, you know, it's created kind of a regional conflict that, you know, people in the Western UP say, you know what, we're the ones with the wolves. We're the ones, you know, who want to be allowed to hunt them, or at least let hunters in to hunt them. And we don't want, you know, the Humane Society in Oakland County, you know, determining how we should be, you know, managing wildlife up here. And so that's a big part of the argument.
Interesting. The legislature also approved a budget supplemental this week that had $215 million earmarked to roads, which people are pleased about to a point, I'm sure. Is it clear how much this will do for Michigan roads?
Well, the issue there is, you know, not a whole lot going forward. Because what this really does mostly is backfill money that's already been spent on plowing and salting and patching potholes.
Yeah.
Well, what's happened is, you know, this winter has been so long, brutal, and snowy that we're finding local governments, as well as the Michigan Department of Transportation, has been dipping into its summer funds for the things that they do when the weather gets warmer. And so you know, we needed to replace that lost money. It also does, you know, put some more money into, you know, some summer road projects as well. But a lot of this is just is just backfilling money that's already been spent on road maintenance and repair.
We're talking with Rick Pluta, the Michigan Public Radio Network's State Capitol Bureau Chief in Lansing. I keep wondering, and I'm sure other people do as well, if a hideous enough pothole season might change some minds regarding the governor's more comprehensive, more expensive approach to Michigan road investment. Is that possible, or are we in long term for just more of the same?
Yeah, it's sort of an irony of, you know, what are you wishing for? If you're Governor Snyder, what are you wishing for going forward? That, especially in an election year, that everything just kind of, you know, muddles along okay? Or, you know, would you really like to see, you know, the world record pothole out there so you can point to it and, you know, maybe stand inside it and go see?
Precisely.
And we are seeing, you know, some really, really big ones. That there is a huge one. I just saw a picture of it in Dearborn that was taken yesterday, and it's like, you know, the car is leaning in it. That, you know, that we're starting to see them. But, you know, one of the new wrinkles, communications wrinkles, is we're talking a little bit more about bridges. And so, you know, the governor, when he's making his pitch, saying, well, look, if you're a commuter on a highway and you go over or under eight bridges, one of them is, you know, considered in not good condition. But then he's got to turn around and go, it's not that it's not safe. You know, don't stop driving. You know, I mean, don't, you know, not take the bridges. But, you know, at some point you make the case by, you know, showing, you know, a car that's had a piece of concrete dropped on it, you know, a car, you know, that's sitting, you know, in a pothole with a, you know, with a broken axle, and saying this is what we, you know, this is what we are reaping by not putting money into roads.
But could a few dramatic episodes or photographs like that actually change the debate?
Well, they have not in the past. That, you know, this road funding issue has been around for a long time, and groups like the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, Brooks Patterson over in Oakland County likes to do this. They'll have pothole contests, you know, send us a picture of the worst pothole that you've seen. And it hasn't really changed the conversation. But this winter has been particularly bad, and it's been interjected by these thaws, which have made the have made the problem a lot worse. So you know, you get a few days of warm weather, and then just like we saw this week, you know, bang, one more winter storm, and that makes the cracks wider, the potholes bigger and deeper, and the bridges get hit that much more.
There were reports that a vote might come yesterday on a fairly divisive proposal to expand Michigan's Education Achievement Authority. That did not come to pass. This is the EAA, of course, is the state government body running Michigan's poorest performing schools right now in Detroit. But this proposal would expand their purview. Could we have a vote on EAA expansion when the legislature reconvenes on Tuesday?
Conceivably, but this is, you remember the old Maxwell Smart line from Get Smart, where he keeps going, missed it by this much.
There's some arm twisting going on.
Some arm twisting going on that this is a priority of the governor's, but the House Republican caucus in particular is very, very divided on this. And so, you know, they keep trying to come up with something that'll wrangle in enough people to do it, but local superintendents are skeptical. They're getting pushback from some of their teachers, and Democrats are not going to provide Republicans with the winning margin with the margin on this.
Mm-hmm. We'll keep an eye on it. Rick Pluta, our State Capitol Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, along with Jake Neer, comprised the MPRN's army of two at the state capitol. Thanks, Rick.
Capital ninjas.
Nothing but rainbows in my sky. I was doing all right till you came by. I had no cause to complain. Life was as sweet as cherry pie. Never minded the rain till you came by. Now whenever you're away, can't sleep nights and suffer all the day. I just sit and wonder if love isn't one big blunder. But when you hold me tight.
Brush Street, Mike Brush on piano, Julie Mullady, our vocalist, and we'll be talking with Brush Street coming up in a little bit. They hail from the Saginaw area, and they are performing as part of the Michigan Jazz Trail. We'll re-explore what the Michigan Jazz Trail is all about here in a few minutes with Brush Street. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Drunk driving has been a public safety problem for years across the United States. A similar and growing threat is that of drugged driving, and Current State's Melissa Benmark has looked into this recently. Hi, Melissa.
Hey, Mark. There's some new law enforcement programs that are targeting people who get behind the wheel under the influence of various drugs, as well as alcohol, sometimes in combination with alcohol. And, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that driving a 4,000-pound machine when you're under the influence of something is bad, but it's a really interesting problem. I talked yesterday with a Michigan police officer who's undergone the special training in order to spot drugged drivers.
My name is Wes Evans. I'm a police officer with Graham Lake Township Police Department, just outside of Flint, Michigan. I'm a certified drug recognition expert instructor, credentialed by International Association of Chiefs of Police.
First of all, my understanding is that this is a fairly new designation. Why is it being done?
Well, it's relatively new to Michigan, but for nationally, it's ancient history. Michigan is actually the 47th state to adopt a program called the Drug Recognition Expert Program, otherwise known as the Drug Evaluation and Classification Program, that's been supported by the federal government for many years. We became officially in the program in 2010.
And what does the program enable officers to do?
It trains certain highly motivated officers that are passionate about impaired driving enforcement, are hand-selected for the training. And it's an intensive program. that trains them to a certain standard, an expert level, if you will, to be able to identify drivers that are impaired by substances other than or in addition to alcohol.
And what are you seeing on the roads these days?
You name it. Drug impairment is probably, I would say it is the fastest growing public safety threat on Michigan roads. And not only Michigan roads, but on a national stage as well. It can range anywhere from prescription medication that might be diverted from the system and people are abusing them on a street level. It can range also to cannabis abuse. It can also range all the way to things that we don't consider to be drugs in society, like the inhalants, such as nitrous oxide. Believe it or not, there are people out there that take these commercial chemicals into their bodies to get a euphoric effect and then couple that with driving. That is something that's certainly been a concern as of late and is certainly on the rise in Michigan with that particular type of drug category.
Is drunk driving up or down or the same? Or
overall, the statistics I've seen from the state have been a downward trend as far as alcohol-impaired driving arrests. And that's, I think, is a good thing in the respect that maybe it's had a downward trend. But the crashes, the injuries, the fatalities are up. They're actually on an upward trend, not only for alcohol, but impaired driving in general, particularly drugs.
It seems like people would be using a lot of different things and maybe sometimes not just one thing, but a couple of drugs or stimulants. How are you able to identify, just generally, if somebody is driving under the influence of something other than alcohol?
Well, in the DRE, in the drug recognition expert arena, generally we say that, a person behaves like the drug they're under the influence of or the drugs they're under the influence of. For instance, a person who's under the influence of a central nervous system stimulant like methamphetamine may be easily agitated, be fidgety, they can't stand still, they can't seem to focus on a particular task as well, even though they may believe in their mind they are. Their driving may be affected in a way that they may become more aggressive in traffic. They may be involved in more of these so-called road rage incidents and things that we hear about on the streets, more prone to violent acts. Whereas a person under the influence of a narcotic analgesic like heroin may be more of the person that you'll find slumped over at the wheel at a traffic light or someone that nods off and drives into a ditch late at night or in that type of scenario. The drugs affect, and then you figure in polydrug use, which is using multiple drugs, multiple kinds of drugs, the dynamic changes. The dynamic totally changes, and it's going to depend on which drug is affecting a particular indicator that we look for of impairment at that time.
Alcohol, in some ways, seems a little bit easier to diagnose, maybe is the wrong word, but to figure out because that you can, someone can take a breathalyzer test. How do you, as an officer, how are you able to, I guess, kind of cover your bases in terms of if you think someone is driving impaired from some other substance, what backup do you have to prove that in court besides your observations?
The drug recognition expert program, the as far as what the officers are trained to look for when they're doing traffic stops on the road, is we're training from the beginning. We look at a baseline in that what is a normal person acting like? What is a sober person looking like? And then you look at a person that's impaired. What are their characteristics? How are they different? We train them also to keep in mind too that there are certain medical conditions that can, to a degree, and I say that to a degree, only to a degree, mimic certain types of drug impairment. Like, for instance, a person that's having a diabetic emergency, could to a degree, at first glance, look like a person that may be intoxicated on alcohol. But we train them to look for those signs and symptoms that are different from a person that's having a diabetic situation that points more toward alcohol. In other words, we look, a person may have an odor of alcoholic beverages. They may have certain eye movement characteristics that are totally different than a person that was having some sort of a diabetic issue in that particular instance alone. you know, someone that may have another type of disorder, like a Parkinson type disorder, you know, that person may appear at first glance like a person to a degree that could have a stimulant type influence. But those individuals are very much alert. They're very aware of their surroundings, and it's going to be, you know, for instance, pupil size will generally be normal, reactive, and those types of things, and they wouldn't be looked at as being impaired as a, by a chemical. Very much distinguishable difference when the person's trained to know what to look for.
The ranks of police and emergency services people have gone down significantly, really even just since 2001. It seems like, on the one hand, it's a really good idea to have people looking for impaired drivers, have officers looking for drivers on other things besides alcohol. But on the other hand, the forces have been cut back so much. Do you fear or do you have concerns that this is going to end up being yet another thing that officers are going to be expected to do that maybe there's not the resources to support?
Well, you know, this is something that we have to make time. Officers have to make time for. We have to allow for them to have the training to be able to have this ability. Because if they don't, literally, people are going. There's going to be more injuries. There's going to be more deaths on the highways as a result, and more impaired drivers would escape even being prosecuted. And that's the ultimate result. We want to correct that behavior. We don't even want the person on the road to begin with. We want them to hopefully, you know, we certainly don't condone any sort of substance abuse, but the hope is that they will think twice before driving.
The loosening of marijuana laws and the medical marijuana changes have brought this subject somewhat up. What's your take on how that's going to complicate screening people for impairment?
We train officers in impairment-based enforcement. If the person is behind the wheel of a vehicle, they are responsible for that vehicle and what that vehicle does. If they are impaired by a chemical, regardless of the chemical, then they can expect to be arrested. It doesn't matter if they have a prescription for it. It doesn't matter if they have a doctor's recommendation for that. If they are impaired and they're behind the wheel, you know, they're going to be treated just like a person that's had too many drinks of alcohol. I mean, it has to come back to what we're trained to look for. We're training officers to remove impaired drivers from the road. The medical marijuana issue has no bearing on that with us because driving under the influence is driving under the influence regardless. And no one should be out there in that respect. And no one should have a special, you know, treatment other ways because it is what the citizens deserve. They deserve safe roadways. They deserve safe travel. And, you know, chemical, regardless of the chemical, that's what we're going to do.
What do you think in the impaired driving category? What do you see? Is there a particular drug that frightens you the most when you see people using it in driving?
No. I look at them all. In the Drug Recognition Expert Program, we have a symbol, a national symbol. And it's an eagle, as a matter of fact. It's an eagle. Number one, the eagle represents strength and courage. It also is the traditional symbol of law enforcement as well. In one of the eagle's talons, in one talon, is a cluster of grapes that represents the drug alcohol, which is the oldest drug. And alcohol is a drug. We don't need to forget that alcohol is a drug. In the other talon, there are seven arrows. Those seven arrows represent the seven broad categories of drugs that we train officers in to look for in impaired driving issues. Now, one arrow isn't sharper than the other. One arrow isn't bigger than the other. They're all equal in size, and that's really the way I look at it. You know, it doesn't matter about the chemical. It matters if you're operating a vehicle, are you fit to drive? And if you're unfit to drive because of chemicals you've taken into your body, then that is impaired driving, and that's illegal.
Wes Evans, thanks very much for joining us.
All right, thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
The flowers you bring me are fine, the trinkets, the cards, and the wine. The nights on the town are sublime. There's only one thing on my mind, the feel of warmth. dripping from your fingertips, the taste of warm chocolate, taking little sips from your lips. The poetry soft in my ear, whispering hard and sincere. The jazz playing bluesy and cool. There's only one thing left to do. I want the warm chocolate dripping from your face.
Music like warm chocolate here on Current State, and it's being performed by Brush Street. Mike Brush on piano, Julie Malady on vocals, and we'll be talking with the members of Brush Street coming up in a few minutes here on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Right now, Current State contributor Scott Southard offers his take on another Michigan notable book for 2014. This is Donald Lystra's short story collection, Something That Feels Like Truth.
Traditionally, short stories are birthed out of what-ifs. What if you go to Mars and find dead relatives? What if a sea monster confuses a foghorn with a mating call? Both of those examples, by the way, are from master short story writer Ray Bradbury. In Donald Lystra's latest story collection, Something That Feels Like Truth, he does something very different from Bradbury. In many ways, his Michigan short stories are not what-ifs, but episodes. They are brief glimpses into the lives of real people, and each is at a turning point or a moment of self-realization. These are character studies, focused more on the emotional impact of a moment than on a surprising plot twist. While most of the stories are based in Michigan or filled with Michigan-like characters, the funny thing is, my favorite story doesn't even take place in our state, but instead in France. The story, The 5 o'clock Train, follows a struggling married couple vacationing. She is artistic, he is more analytical, and tolerates what he considers her romantic view of the world. Their relationship comes to a head while visiting the resting place of Vincent van Gogh. Lystra's stories are each very well written and captivating. There are no sea creatures, but normal people with normal problems. And while there are no ghosts either, each of his characters is haunted by choices that they've made in the past and the choices they will make before the story comes to an end. The only complaint I have with this fascinating collection of stories is that they can feel kind of redundant at times. Most of the stories involve men in the later end of middle age. You never get the female perspective, really, and everyone's relationship is usually on the brink of disaster or just afterwards. There are also themes of lost youth and approaching demise that seem to run throughout. These are not stories about beginnings, but endings, rather bleak when put all together in one book. Something That Feels Like Truth is a 2014 Michigan Notable Book selection, and it definitely deserves it. The writing is first rate. Lystra was once an engineer, and you can almost feel that necessary precision in his writing. While the prose won't sweep you away with its beauty, there is an exactness that emphasizes the truth in his words. This is a wonderful collection, but a part of me wishes it included at least one monster. A monster in Lystra's world would have been a fun what-if. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
Scott Southard is the author of two novels, A Jane Austen Daydream and Maximilian Standforth in the Case of the Dangerous Dare. His writing on a variety of topics can also be found online at sdsouthard.com. His blog is called The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to Current State on WKAR. You can follow us on Twitter at @KARCurrentState. You can email us anytime at currentstate@wkar.org. What's coming to movie theaters this spring? Well, each season, MLive's John Serba offers his thoughts on soon-to-be-released films. This week, he shared his most and least anticipated movies of the spring season with Current State's Emmanuel Berry.
What does it mean to be a spring movie?
Someone was arguing with me on Facebook, like,
it's not spring yet. And I was like, well, the movie, see, you know, it's hot, it's Hollywood and it's different.
So there isn't quite a definite term for a spring movie then.
No, not really. I mean, you know, Hollywood summer starts in May, you mm-hmm. know what I mean, with all the big blockbusters. So it's they're very loose definitions.
So a movie which some people seem to be really excited about, and by that I mean my friend from high school who explained to me several times this weekend that I must go see this movie, Divergent, which I've never really heard of, never read the books. It seems to be kind of walking along the Twilight, Hunger Games tightrope. You have this on your most anticipated list. Is it going to fill the void that Twilight left in your heart?
This actually, Divergent feels more like Hunger Games light a little bit, because you have the female protagonist, and it's Shailene Woodley, who seems like she might be on kind of a similar career track as Jennifer Lawrence. So, and then you know, obviously it takes place in the future. It's this kind of dystopian thing, and she's sort of a chosen one type figure, and so Summit is the studio behind it, who no longer have the Twilight cash cow from before, and so they're working real hard to make this the next kind of franchise for them. These kind of teen book series translations can be real hit or miss. The Hunger Games and Twilight and Harry Potter are the big ones, and the other ones are kind of like, does anybody remember the Spiderwick Chronicles? No. which they tried to launch several years back during the same time of year, during quote-unquote spring. And so I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how Divergent plays out. Like I said, Shailene Woodley, really good. She's probably got an Oscar in her future. You know, we saw her in The Descendants. Kate Winslet is in a supporting role. There's kind of a generic guy love interest in this, played by some generic looking fellow. We'll see if, you know, and there's a big push recently to sell tickets in advance, buy your tickets in advance. And you know, when that happens, that they're trying to make it the next, you know, major Hollywood franchise. We'll see what happens, though.
Wes Anderson has another offering for us this spring, the Grand Budapest Hotel. First, break down the plot for us, because from the preview, I'm totally confused as to what's going on. There's a lot of people in this film.
We could fill the entire segment here just naming who's actually in the movie.
Yeah.
And it's essentially Ralph Fiennes, not Ralph, Ralph,
also runs known as Lord Voldemort. Sorry. He's always Lord Voldemort to me. He will never be anything else.
Oh, so many other things.
I know, but I can't help it. I'm ruined. Anyway, sorry. Continue.
He's like the... I don't know if hotel concierges can be legendary, but that's the word that's being bandied about around his character. And I guess in the Wes Anderson world, I guess he can be. You know, it's kind of his story. It's a post-war European hotel, and there are any number of eccentric guests in eccentric-looking rooms. And the story, are we really that concerned about the story? We just want to see these people arranged in Wes Anderson's meticulous, symmetrical shots with all the crazy, detailed background set design and production and all that kind of stuff. Adrian Brody, Willem Dafoe, Jeff Goldblum, Harvey Keitel, Jude Law, Bill Murray, Edward Norton, Saoirse Ronan, Tilda Swinton, of course. So there's some Wes Anderson mainstays in there and a few new ones. This opened last week in four theaters across the country, and it's already done $1 million.
All right, so we have, from the director of Black Swan and The Wrestler, a film of biblical proportions, like literally of biblical proportions. Aronofsky has taken on the story of Noah, and for me, this just screams bomb.
Aronofsky doesn't really make bad movies. He makes, they're all of his films are kind of are very ambitious, and some of them are ambitious failures. We'll see. I mean, this is the first time that anyone has handed him a whole bunch of money and said, make this, like, grand, giant, big screen epic. So it's not only, you know, a weird kind of, well, the story of Noah's Ark, what? and it's not one of those faith-based movies that basically exists to preach its own kind of message. And we'll kind of see if he kind of courts any of that type of audience. I don't see him doing it, to be honest. So it may be a failure to that niche. And it's very likely it may be a failure to everybody because you just have this, what looks like a train wreck of CG and Russell Crowe bellowing and lots of water. And, it could be, you know, kind of an impressive spectacle, or it could be a complete train wreck. And so that has the wanna see factor high, and as far as I'm concerned.
Just
anyway.
Want to know where it goes.
Yes. Yes. We want to see what happens.
All right. So probably one of the most unquestionable movies that a lot of people are anticipating is Captain America, the Winter Soldier. And the first Captain America was campy. It was a lot of nostalgia, not a lot of flash. But I kind of liked it that way because that's what Captain America is. He is he's Captain America, plain and simple. He is Cap. But this movie looks a little different from the first one. What are you expecting?
You know, it's hard to get too excited. I temper my enthusiasm for all these Marvel movies when you look at the person who's directing it and you go, who? And that's something that kind of is a concern, because at least, you know, the first Thor movie was directed by Kenneth Branagh, and I think it was Joe Carnahan who directed the first Captain America. These are well-established directors, and now they're bringing on newcomers as if, like, let's maximize our profits. And so that's my biggest concern with this. But, you know, if they'll maintain that kind of gee whiz, look at Captain America, he's a virgin kind of thing of the last one, it's not. It's set
it's
in the modern day.
Yes.
I thought the first one was really solid, you know. I mean, it's firmly, like, in the top, you know, 10 Marvel movies, top 5 maybe. I don't know. I don't think anybody has really handled these characters very well since the Avengers movie came out, because that like hit all the perfect notes with all these characters. And so everything has been a bit of a letdown since then because Joss Whedon kind of set the bar pretty high. My point being, I temper my enthusiasm. I am cautiously optimistic. That's my life philosophy anyway, so.
I think it's a good one to have when approaching Avengers, so.
For sure.
All right, so we've run down some of the highlights of your anticipated list, which is on MLive, but there are several spring films that you're not as excited to see. You're going to see them still, but maybe grab some extra snacks to keep yourself occupied. So first, let's touch on Tyler Perry's Single Mother's Club. And I am not a fan of Tyler Perry. In fact, every single time I go home at TBS or BET, my dad is sitting there watching a Tyler Perry film, and I really don't want to ever have to see this one. So apparently you don't really want to either.
Well, I haven't seen every Tyler Perry film, but the ones I have seen are inept. He always struggles with the kind of tonal transition from comedy to drama. He's a very visually boring director to watch. So it's just kind of, you know, I'm almost to the point where when I look ahead at a season of what's opening and I go, Adam Sandler, no, Tyler Perry, avoid it like the plague, 10-foot poles all around, when you approach that one. He's done that kind of You Go Girl type stuff before. He did Four Colored Girls a few years ago, which was a very well-meaning movie, but I don't think he conveyed his message very well. So Single Moms Club is going to be a little lighter in tone, I'm sure, because it's comedic, and Four Colored Girls was a little heavier subject matter wise. So you have to go, at least he's, doing what Hollywood isn't necessarily doing very well, which is giving solid roles to female protagonists in movies. And so I'm sure there's well-meaning motivation behind making this movie, but we'll see if he can execute it without relying on the same old cliches, which I'm very, very much worried that he will do.
Well, I hate to end on a downer, so why don't you give us one more film from your most anticipated list? Maybe something that we wouldn't expect to see.
How about let's go with Sabotage.
Really? I said not a downer.
Sabotage. Let's face it. Arnold Schwarzenegger, since he is no longer in politics, he's come back to movies. A little over a year ago, he did a movie called The Last Stand, which kind of, it was a riff on everything that he's done before. But he doesn't take himself very seriously anymore. And I think that's really good. I think that's an interesting stage of his career where he can be in an action comedy and be light on his feet. I mean, with a guy who basically has a 20-pound weight wrapped around his tongue because of his whole because of his accent. And so anyway, he did this movie called The Last Stand last year in January, which I thought was a lot of fun, actually. And then he did Escape Plan with Sylvester Stallone, which was a horrible movie, but he was. That was another one where he was like, I think I'm going to play this a little tongue-in-cheek, and everybody else took it seriously, and so he kind of stood out. He plays a DEA agent running around with a machine gun, and it's like, let's see if he can kind of keep this role going where maybe he can forge a second plateau on his career and do something interesting, and this movie is there's a real director behind this movie, Sabotage, David Ayer. He did End of Watch, which was pretty well received, and Harsh Times with Christian Bale a few years ago. So we'll see if Arnold still has it, I don't see it being a big blockbuster and making hundreds of millions, but I see it might actually, there's a small chance it might be interesting to watch, an entertaining movie, potentially, maybe it's a creative endeavor for Arnold. We'll see.
John, always the optimist. John Serba is an entertainment reporter and film critic for MLive and the Grand Rapids Press. I'm sure we'll be chatting again soon, right before summer blockbusters come out. John, as always, it's a pleasure.
Thanks. I'm looking forward to talking to you again.
For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
And I'm Mark Bayshore. Throughout the program here on Live Music Friday, we've been hearing Brush Street, which features Julie Malady on vocals and Michael Brush on piano. We're going to hear an original composition by the pianist right now, Mike Brush. This is called Can You Feel the Glow?
Can you feel it? Can you feel the glow? Like a candle burning in the soul, illuminates the truth we know, unknowingness that makes us whole. Can you feel it? Can you feel the glow? Can you see it? Can you the glow. There beyond the glitter and the bows, a million colored lights fall far below a single glistening star. Can you see it? Can you see the glow? The dim, just stop and take it in. Accept this crazy time for what it is. So close your eyes and feel the giving of the present that we're living. Can you feel it? Can
Brush Street on Current State here on WKAR. Mike Brush on piano, an original composition there, Can You Feel the Glow? And Julie Malady is the vocalist for Brush Street. We're going to talk to the players here for just, the musicians, I should say, here for just a few minutes. Welcome to Current State, Julie, and welcome back, Mike.
Good morning.
Mike's been here once before.
Yep.
Julie, when did you start singing?
Oh, I've been singing for many, many years. I started mostly in high school. I was in the high school choir and the theater program there, and that's where it all got started.
Listen to that voice.
And I used to sing when I was a young little girl, too, but that's when I first started really getting interested, was when I was in high school.
You have a wonderful tone.
Well,
really,
thank you.
Really, it really sounded special here today. And Mike, you're back for a second time. We're delighted to see you as well. Julie, how did you end up singing jazz and blues as opposed to rock or klezmer or something else?
It started when I began working with Mike. We have been working together for almost a little over 10 years. And we were teachers together in our school district, and we started getting together for some of the retirement dinners and different types of events with school. And then we got together after that. He was playing at a local restaurant in a jazz club here in Saginaw, and I stepped in for a few songs, and the guy said, "Hey, let's go for it." And there you go. That's how it all started.
Yeah, you gotta get her.
Good fun.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mike, you spent many years as an educator, as a music educator.
Yeah, about 30. Yeah.
Okay. And did you teach piano? Did you teach orchestra, band, singing? What?
First 20 years, I was a traveling music teacher, and later on in that phase of teaching, I put together an all-city choir and used a lot of songs that I'd written for that choir to sing. And that was, we ended up going to Washington, D.C. and so on. So that was a kind of a special community thing. And the songs were all kind of socially conscious type of material.
Okay.
Yeah. So
Are you both Michigan natives?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And who do you look up to in music, Julie? I mean, is there somebody that just blew you away as a young person who you just wanted to emulate, wanted a career like? I mean, you got into education, I understand, but as far as your performing style, is there somebody that's really that you've always looked up to, a musical role model?
Well, I really enjoyed just being involved in a lot of different shows, and I liked all of the songs from musical theater. And then as I moved into singing with jazz and different types of vocalists, you know, and I started listening to many, many vocalists. So I certainly enjoy the likes of Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan, and I also enjoy Linda Etter. She's been a huge influence on me.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, are you still performing as an actor then, or not, in musical theater?
Not as much right now, but no.
You're busy with
Mike. We're busy doing our musical duo and group and different
just
musical
enough to
things.
Not be able to commit to the put a show together.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it takes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the CDs here. You're responsible. I know, Mike. You're responsible for three. And Julie is on all three.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a fourth that they don't have here, but that features a lot of the songs that were written for Linda Etter. That was the first one that we did.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a Christmas or a holiday one that has some songs that have been written over time. That last song that we did will be on the next time we do a holiday song. I wrote that just before a concert we had this past December. A week before that.
And you are both involved in the Michigan Jazz Trail.
Yep.
Remind us what that is and what's upcoming with the Michigan Jazz Trail.
The Michigan Jazz Trail was the kind of brainchild of Molly McFadden, and who was able to kind of lead the way and get people charged up about the idea of promoting musicians kind of regionally and long-term statewide. And I think with the idea of even having the Jazz Trail, like a vision would be to have events going on where one could travel around the state and that kind of thing.
Very neat.
So, yeah, so we have some dates coming up with the Jazz Trail.
Hit us with the next two, let's
but
say.
The last one was pretty cool, Wynton Marsalis.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we opened for that. Yeah, it was very cool.
Very special.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what's coming up then, briefly?
Probably the next thing looks like June 4th. We're going to be the headline. Michigan Jazz Trail will be the headliners on Jazz on Jefferson, which is in downtown Saginaw, June 4th. Lots of different acts, and that's a free concert.
So Brush Street, Jazz on Jefferson in downtown Saginaw.
And that's in the Michigan Jazz Trail Big Band will be the headliners for that. We've been the headliners
for
the past. But
why don't you reassume your positions and we'll give you an opportunity to play us out. We've been talking with Julie Mullady and Mike Brush of Brush Street as they return to their positions at the piano and the microphone. We'll remind you that next week on Current State, we explore local stock exchanges. Local stock exchanges, it's true. Also, a look at zombie culture in higher education. That and more next week on Current State. To take us out, Brush Street on 90.5. WKAR. Have a great day.
There's a curve in the road up ahead, they're saying. A curve in the road, watch out. Oh, they're telling me to keep my eyes on the road. I don't know what they're talking about. I turn the radio down and your width's up high. The shoulder tends to give way. Oh, they're telling me to keep my eyes on the road. What's the meaning of the words they say? I'm just trying to keep it between the lines. I'm running low on fuel, running low on time. They're telling me what? There's a curve in the road. I might be heading for trouble, but I'm already too far from home. I'm lost in your trap.
WKAR is supported by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu.